From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
One thing that Giuliani raised today that was very valid is the handling of these mail-in ballots. Mm-hmm. Were mail-in ballots that were counted that should have been rejected for irregularities, like the signatures didn't match or the voter information wasn't what didn't match up with the record?
Serious questions 3 weeks after the election that will not go away. That was Mark Dyson, a columnist with the Washington Post, certainly no ally of Rudy Giuliani or Donald Trump.
If that was done in great enough numbers, that could tip the election. But the problem is you can't fix that after the fact because the ballot is separated from the voter information to preserve secrecy. So really the only way you can find out is by checking the rejection rates mm-hmm. in this election to previous elections and see if they're consistent. And the preliminary data says they're not. In Georgia, the rejection rate this year right now stands at 0.2%, which mm-hmm. is 30 mm-hmm. times lower than 2016. In Pennsylvania, it's 0.03% compared to 1% in 2016. In Nevada, it's 0.75% this year, which is half of the 1.6 rate in 2016. So in each of these states, the rejection rate was lower mm-hmm. than 4 years ago. That's in a year where millions of people were voting for the first time and were more likely to make mistakes. So counting ballots that were irregular, it's not the same as stuffing yeah. ballots, it's not the same as a communist conspiracy, but it is a form of voter fraud. If people in these different states were counting ballots that favored Biden, that shouldn't have been counted mm-hmm. in the first place.
This past Monday, the Trump campaign said the state legislatures in Pennsylvania, Arizona, and Michigan would be holding public hearings on the 2020 presidential election. These would be separate from the various court and administrative challenges currently underway. Officials in those key states had disputed whether any such hearings would take place, but it appeared that the dispute was over terminology and process. In other words, the technical over the material. Trump's campaign said that the first gathering would be held by the Pennsylvania State Senate on Wednesday in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and that was set to feature testimony from witnesses who have filed affidavits attesting to 2020 election fraud. It would also feature a presentation from former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who serves as President Trump's personal attorney and is leading the campaign's legal challenges surrounding the election. Giuliani issued a statement Tuesday saying the following, quote, "It's in everyone's interest to have a full vetting of election irregularities and fraud, and the only way to do this is with public hearings, complete with witnesses, videos, pictures, and other evidence of illegalities from the November 3rd election," closed quote. Meanwhile, the Trump campaign claimed that next Monday, November 30th, the Arizona legislature would also hold a hearing, followed by one in the Michigan legislature on December 1st. An Arizona GOP official told Fox News Monday that the Speaker of the Arizona House had not authorized any such hearing. And in Michigan, a member of the legislature reportedly told the Detroit News that no such hearing would occur. Instead, the official said there were discussions about having Giuliani testify. Michigan State House Oversight Committee Chair Matt Hall, a Republican, told the Detroit News, quote, "We've just determined that logistically, it's not something we're going to be able to do," closed quote. At present, the election returns remain unsettled in a sufficient number of states to make it impossible to name a winner just yet. The narrow margins in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada are being challenged in a number of venues, including court cases, appeals, recounts, and other procedural activities. As we've reported previously, despite the apparent agreement by the corporate media over this past week to award Democratic candidate former Vice President Joe Biden 302 electoral votes. In fact, his total of finally certified votes still falls short of the required 270. Again, if the legal efforts of President Trump are successful, they could award him enough electoral votes to win. The federal case brought by Trump in Pennsylvania's Middle District Court against that state's election authorities, which was dismissed at the trial level this past Saturday, is currently on appeal. And Trump's attorneys, who said they expected to lose at the trial level, have articulated a legal strategy pointed at the U.S. Supreme Court. They filed and served a notice of appeal from the judge's orders hours after it was published this past weekend, and they were joined by a group of Pennsylvania voters seeking to intervene with claims under the First Amendment, Equal Protection, and Due Process clauses of the U.S. Constitution. Any state certifications of the vote would be subject to the outcome of these lawsuits, and in the event either case prevails, the parties would be forced to comply with the court's direction. Meanwhile, the vote in Michigan was certified with one abstention, but Trump's lawyers pointed out that this was a necessary procedural step before certain formal challenges could be presented, which they promised to bring. They also pointed to pending litigation, including a case in Wayne County, which raised claims of fraud, ballot stuffing, and other criminal activity, which could hand the state to Trump if successful. Process continued also in Georgia, where election officials began a recount of votes Tuesday. According to the Secretary of State's office, that must be completed by midnight December 2nd. It's the third tally of votes in a race decided by the narrowest of margins, with Biden defeating Trump by just 12,670 votes out of some 5 million cast in Georgia. Certification of the vote in Nevada took place Tuesday, but there are court actions there as well. Arizona and Wisconsin have certification deadlines next week. Arizona appeared to resolve a certification conflict in Maricopa County this past Friday. Meanwhile, the president and the first lady held an annual ritual at the White House on Tuesday. Unlike the annual ritual, however, it began with this announcement.
Well, thank you very much, please. And I just want to congratulate everybody. The Dow Jones Industrial Average just broke for the first time in history 30,000. It's now, that's good. It's great for jobs and it's good for everything. And this is the ninth time that we set a record during the course of 2020. And it's the 48th time that we've set the record during the Trump administration. And there's never been anything like that. So I just want to congratulate everybody that worked so hard, the White House, but maybe most importantly, the people of our country. It's a tremendous achievement. The First Lady and I are thrilled to welcome you all to the beautiful Rose Garden, where the First Lady actually worked very hard on renovating it. It was 61 years. It was in rough shape. A very big job, actually, when you go to the wires underground. People have no idea how complex it is, but you've done a fantastic job. Thank you very much. And we're also very happy to have with us my daughter Ivanka and Jared and Theodore, Arabella, Joseph. Thank you very much for coming. They like the turkey. Thank you very much. On behalf of the entire Trump family, I want to wish every American a healthy and very happy Thanksgiving. We're here today to continue a beloved annual tradition, the official presidential pardon of a very, very fortunate turkey. Because Thanksgiving is a special day for turkeys, I guess probably for the most part not a very good one when you think about it. The first turkey to dodge the White House dinner table received unofficial clemency when President Abraham Lincoln's son, Tad, begged his father to spare his new friend. For the past 73 years, the National Turkey Federation has presented the National Thanksgiving Turkey to the president. Starting under President George H.W. Bush, these birds have received a formal pardon every single year. Today is my honor to present to you this year's lucky bird, Corn, and just in case we needed him, Cobb. Corn and Cobb. That's not too hard to remember, is it? These two magnificent gobblers were selected from the official presidential flock of 30 turkeys, some real beauties. They were raised by the chairman of the National Turkey Federation himself, Ron Cardell. Ron, thank you very much, Ron. Please stand up. Great job. Ron, thank you for being here and your family, beautiful family. Thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it. Like so many presidential flocks, this one started in the great state of Iowa in what can only been described as an act of blatant pandering. And by the way, I love the state of Iowa. These two turkeys sought to win the support of Iowans across the state by naming themselves Corn and Cobb. After today's ceremony, these birds will retire under the care of skilled veterinarians at Iowa State University, a tremendous university in Ames. Once there, people of all ages will be able to visit them and learn about poultry science, veterinary medicine, and the noble American tradition of farming. We love our farmers, I'll tell you. And we hope and we know that's going to happen, that corn and cob have a very long, happy, and memorable life. This year, our nation commemorates the 400th anniversary of the Pilgrims landing on Plymouth Rock. After arriving in the New World, the brave men and women of the Mayflower endured a bitter and dangerous winter, very, very dangerous winter. Many were sick, most were starving, and all were praying for a miracle. Thankfully, God heard their prayers. From our earliest days, America has always been a story of perseverance and triumph, determination and strength, loyalty and faith. This week, in a time that is very unusual, but in so many ways, very, very good, what we've endured and been able to endure with the vaccines now coming out one after another, it's an incredible thing that happened. One of the greatest medical achievements that this planet has ever seen. But it's time to remember that we live in a great, great country, the greatest of them all, and there's nothing even close as far as I'm concerned. Every American can be united in thanksgiving to God for the incredible gifts He has bestowed upon us, the blessings of family, community, and this exceptional, beautiful, and great country. It's greater than ever before. During this Thanksgiving, we extend our eternal gratitude to the doctors, nurses, healthcare workers, and scientists who have waged the battle against the China virus. And we give thanks for the vaccines and therapies that will soon end the pandemic. It's just such a tremendous feeling to know that they're coming, and they'll be coming probably starting next week or shortly thereafter. We send our love to every member of the armed forces and the law enforcement heroes risking their lives to keep America safe, to keep America great. And as I say, America first. Shouldn't go away from that. America first. We give thanks to the priceless freedoms that we've inherited, and we ask God to watch over and protect our nation and its people during this incredible holiday and in all of the years to come. We ask that of God. Once again, Melania and I wish to thank everybody for your incredible courtesies and also wish you a happy Thanksgiving. And now it's time for the moment of our guest of honor. They've been waiting, and in this case, he's been waiting for this. And bring him out. Look at that beautiful, beautiful bird. Oh, so lucky. That is a lucky bird. Corn, I hereby grant you a full pardon. Thank you, Corn. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody. Thank you very much.
As the latest phase of the U.S. war against Afghanistan entered its 20th year this past month, the Trump administration has promised to pull U.S. troops out, with the exception of a small force, before January. This past Monday, the Afghanistan Conference 2020 began. Although based in Geneva, Switzerland, it was held virtually due to the COVID pandemic. On Tuesday, the conference was addressed by U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
Hello, everyone. Secretary Pompeo with you. I first want to thank everyone participating in this conference for your support of the Afghan people. Our meeting comes at a very timely moment. The start of the Afghan peace negotiations in Doha has opened a new and unprecedented opportunity set for peace and prosperity. But at the same time, Afghanistan faces difficult challenges such as the pandemic from Wuhan and unacceptably high levels of violence. The United States remains committed to our own enduring partnership with Afghanistan and to helping these negotiations be successful. So too must all our countries and organizations help to maintain and advance gains achieved since 2001. Those gains include Afghanistan's adherence to the rule of law, respect for its international obligations, and inclusive, transparent, and accountable governance. We must also emphasize the importance of respect for the rights of all Afghans, including women, youth, and minority groups. The government of Afghanistan must also do its part to implement essential elements of stability and security, just as the Afghan people expect. I'm talking about things like economic reforms, real anti-corruption efforts, including our drug interdiction. Respect for human rights, including religious freedom, a welcome environment for the private sector, and steps towards self-reliance. I want to be clear that the choices made in peace negotiations will affect the size and scope of future international support and assistance. The United States looks forward to reviewing progress in the areas I mentioned in 1 year's time. Finally, the United States is looking to our international partners, especially Afghanistan's neighbors and others in the region, to help that country move to a more peaceful, secure, and sustainable future. The contributions made here will be a strong signal for our support for the Afghan people. I know we can help them achieve the good outcomes they so desperately seek. Let's just keep up our good work. Thank you.
Also on Tuesday, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Russian Federation, Sergei Lavrov, addressed the conference.
Ladies and gentlemen, the year 2020 has become for us a year of hope for a possible end of the armed conflict in Afghanistan in the near future and for establishing a lasting and durable peace. Russia welcomed the last February agreement between the Taliban movement and the United States that made it possible to launch the intra-Afghan dialogue in September this year. In 2018 and 2019, Russia made quite an effort to create the necessary conditions and an atmosphere of trust between the parties. Let me recall that it was in the Russian capital at a meeting held in November 2018 in the framework of the so-called Moscow format that delegations of the Taliban and the High Peace Council of Afghanistan, representing in fact the government, engaged for the first time in direct talks in the presence of observers from a dozen of regional countries and the United States. Moscow was also the venue of the first consultations between representatives of the Taliban and the inclusive delegation of Afghan politicians held at the initiative of the Afghan diaspora in Russia in February 2019 in the framework of the intra-Afghan dialogue. We remain concerned with the deteriorating security situation, especially in the north of Afghanistan, where ISIS fighters concentrate their forces and keep trying to create a bridgehead for the expansion to Central Asia. No less dangerous is the high level of production of drugs in Afghanistan, which is a source of financial support for both local and international terrorists. In those circumstances, there is an urgent need for the teams of the negotiators from the Afghan government and the Taliban, currently in session in Doha, to agree as soon as possible on all procedural matters. We call upon both opposing parties, as well as representatives of all Afghan ethno-political groups and outside players interested in stabilizing the situation in the country, to contribute to the end of the protracted intra-Afghan war and the restoration of Afghanistan as a peaceful, secure, independent, and self-sufficient state free from terrorism and drugs. We are committed to promoting intra-Afghan talks in the Troika Plus format with the participation of Russia, the United States, and China, as well as Pakistan. Other partners may also be invited to engage in that work at a later stage. Upon the successful completion of the negotiating process, the international community will be required to take active steps to facilitate the development of post-conflict Afghanistan. Russia, on its part, will be prepared to provide relevant support in various areas such as combating terrorism and drug-related crime, military technological cooperation, specialized and civic training of Afghan citizens and provision of humanitarian assistance, as well as industrial and infrastructural projects of mutual interest. Thank you for your attention.
After Tuesday's session of the UN Conference on Afghanistan, Foreign Minister Lavrov met with the Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein and held a joint press conference Wednesday in Moscow. That press conference lasted about 45 minutes, and we bring you excerpts from it here.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have had very substantive talks. Foreign Minister and Deputy Prime Minister of Iraq, Fuad Hussein, my colleague, we've had a very fruitful meeting.
نائب رئيس الوزراء وزير خارجية الجمهورية العراق وبحثات بناء وشاملة.
Наши страны связывают давние, крепкие...
Our countries are bonded by long years of friendship. 76 years ago, we signed a treaty to establish diplomatic ties between Russia and Iraq. And since then, we've been working actively together in many areas, first and foremost in the energy and defense areas.
Пути дальнейшего углубления нашего экономического сотрудничества.
As for our future cooperation, that will be discussed tomorrow in greater detail. That will be the meeting between the minister and his colleague, or chairman of the Intergovernmental Commission on Trade and Economic Cooperation, Vice Prime Minister Yuri Borisov.
فستتم مناقشتها غدا خلال اللقاء لمعالي الوزير مع السيد يوري بوريسوف رئيس الطرف الروسي للجنة الحكومية المشتركة ونائب رئيس الوزراء.
Мы обменялись мнениями по многим.
Today we have exchanged our opinions on the regional issues. I believe that the cooperation that we have within the UN is very robust, and our opinions towards pushing for peaceful settlement of any disputes, settlement through dialogue between all stakeholders and with support of the international community, is what we believe in as what we uphold.
يوجد أي بديل للتصوية السلمية وعن طريق الحوار لجميع النزاعات بمساعدة الأممية.
Именно с этих позиций и Россия, и Ирак подходят.
Russia and Iraq
различных конфликтов и кризисов на.
Are resolved to solving and settling any conflicts in Middle East and North Africa through peace and dialogue. And I mean Syria, Yemen, and any other parts of this very important region.
الذي يتبناه كل من روسيا والعراق حيال تصوية الأزمات في منطقة الشرق الأوسط وشمال أفريقيا خاصة في سوريا واليمن وغيرها من النقاط الساخنة.
Мы активно сотрудничаем в международных усилиях.
We have very robust cooperation in the international community, doing our best to eradicate the last remnants of the organized crime and terrorists in Syria and Iraq. And for that purpose, we have a special coordination mechanism. It was set up in Baghdad. It's an information set. It brings together military officers from Russia, Syria, and Iraq. Russia fully supports the efforts of Prime Minister Tazemi's efforts to stabilize the situation in the country, eradicate extremists and terrorists, as well as his efforts to prepare for the upcoming parliamentary election.
Наши иракские друзья подтвердили свою заинтересованность.
Our Iraqi friends have confirmed that they take a lot of interest in Russia's efforts, an international effort to help settle the conflict in Syria. Iraq is also an observer party to the Astana format, and we do appreciate Iraq's efforts as well as efforts from many other countries. They contributed to solve the problem of Syrian refugees, and there, as you know, has been a conference on the issue of refugees that took place in Damascus.
Арабо-израильского
конфликта. We discussed the Israeli-Arab conflict and possible settlement, and we believe that Donald Trump's efforts to normalize the relation between individual Arab states and Israel are quite positive, but they should in no way be a replacement for a just and fair settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian issue.
На этот счет есть решение ООН, есть арабская мирная инициатива.
There is a UN resolution, there is Arab Peace Initiative, and these initiatives, they should be implemented. brought to life. Russia and Iraq both take interest in creating the favorable environment for normalizing the situation, building trust and security in the region of the Gulf. Today we confirm our readiness to promote our concept of security for this region, and we are discussing this initiative with our colleagues from the Arab countries, those who are close to the Gulf and other countries as well, as well as we are discussing it with UN Security Council permanent members and other stakeholders. All in all, I believe that ministers' participation can help to promote our cooperation across the board, as well as it is, will help us to find more opportunities to reinforce peace and stability in the Middle East. As for Russia, we work closely with Iraq and other countries in the region fighting terrorism together. And we do that irregardless of what plans the U.S. has, whether they withdraw from some country or they come back. We have long-lasting agreements. We have an information center in Baghdad, and there we have Russian, Iraqi, Iran, and Syrian military specialists working hand-in-hand. Another aspect of our anti-terrorist cooperation, we discuss it today, and that is the so-called the issue of foreign fighters. They mostly come from the European countries. They started flooding the region to take part in the illicit activities and terrorist activities in the Middle East. Many of them have been arrested already, and it is our belief that they should be tried fairly in the countries where they came to, like Iraq, Syria, Libya, or countries where they committed terrorist acts. All other options are not legitimate, so we call upon our Western partners not to put up any legal obstacles on the way. If these are your citizens, then you should trial them. If they are in another country and they committed a terrorist act, a terrorist crime, then they should be trialed there. As you probably know, among those foreign fighters been involved in the illicit activities in the region are some Russian citizens. There's also a problem. But there is also a bigger problem, the problem of children, Russian children. And we are thankful to Iraq for the coordination that it maintains with the Children's Rights Ombudsman and Russia's authorities. You are helping us to get these children back. Almost all the children who've been identified as Russians have been transferred back to Russia, and this is a very important step for our cooperation.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.